Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is August 17th, 2017, and this is episode 48. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. On today's show, we're going to do a bit of a catch-up, as over the past couple of weeks I was in Ottawa, so we had sort of special edition episodes. So we have to take a look at what's been happening in BC politics and Canadian politics more generally. And then we have a sort of special interview about white supremacy in British Columbia with the two of the organizers of the upcoming anti-racist rally that's happening in town on Saturday afternoon. But before we get to all of that, first we have a bit of a special announcement. We're coming up on our 50th episode in a couple weeks, and that's as good of a reason as any, I think, to have another live show slash party. We're still sorting out the specific details and the agenda and all that kind of stuff. But for now, mark August 31st, the Thursday, on your calendars, and you'll be able to find us once again at Jaeger's in downtown Vancouver after 7 p.m. Details will, in theory, be on our Facebook page and in the show notes if I do my job. But let's jump into the show. Segment one, let's catch up on BC. First up, I think let's talk about fundraising. Elections BC released data on how fundraising went for the main political parties this past week, but I think a bigger story, at least for a couple days, was this fundraiser John Horgan did at a golf course for $500 a head.
So the NDP took a little heat just 2 weeks ago now over a fundraiser that's being planned for August 24th at Bear Mountain, and particularly because it's one of those big, fancy $500 a plate dinners, and this kind of goes against the spirit of the fundraising reform that has been promised, was a campaign issue, feature of the agreement between the Greens and the NDP, and this is all happening while David Eby's making some noises about, we're not quite ready to actually do our fundraising bill yet.
Or we want to take our time and get it exactly perfect, which is really disingenuous when you've also put forward six bills on the subject. Were none of those good enough? It's also disingenuous when we have nine other provinces that have better rules than us to look at, including next door in Alberta, where they brought in fundraising bans as Bill 1.
Yeah, and here you can literally take the next least restrictive version of fundraising and just bring that in. You know, it's already been litigated out. There's none of those concerns. So the fact that they're, not ready to do that is not something that reflects well on the NDP, because, either they've put six bad bills in front of the legislature, which, they're basically very simple little bills, so they clearly were more symbolic. But either they put bad bills in, or, they're drained their feet and don't want to actually do the thing they promised to do.
And a potential hint at that is in that data I referred to that just came out this week, which showed between January 1st and May 9th, the NDP actually outfundraised the BC Liberals, which is almost a historic first, or at least in recent history. For example, last year in 2016, the NDP raised about $4.8 million, while the Liberals raised $12.2 million, almost triple. But during the sort of election and lead up this year, the NDP raised over $9 million compared to the Liberals' $7.6 million that they raised in the same period. So what you have is one of the first really successful actually end of NDP fundraising periods. And maybe they got addicted. Maybe they liked it. And it's worrying. I think they can still recover. It's not hard to bring forward a bill and change some of these rules. But they're clearly not going to go for the retroactive cancel out corporate and union donations that have happened since the election.
Well, they need to recover, because this was one of the main points of agreement between them and the NDP that was instrumental in them taking power after the election. So either they follow through on this, or we're probably going to be going back to the polls pretty quickly.
Which would be really tough for the Liberals, who don't have a leader right now. The other thing that came out in this data dump was that in this election, it was probably one of the most expensive in BC's history. The Liberals spent $13.6 million, the NDP spent $7.9 million, and the Greens spent $900,000, which also raises the question of, does the NDP actually have a debt? Because it seems like they raised over $1 million more than they actually spent. So maybe there's some outstanding debt from previous elections. The Greens apparently raised about the same amount they spent. And the Liberals had a war chest built from previous years. So we're still waiting to see what the NDP does. There's no one out there other than potentially people within the party who are very quiet saying not doing this is a good idea. Even the Liberals are going to give them hell if they don't do anything. So, easy win. Come on, guys.
Yeah, hell, the Liberals even threw them a bone by promising that in their throne speech. So, at this moment, there's no reason not to do it. Everyone's basically in agreement with the worst province for this sort of thing. So the fact that the NDP is dragging their feet just doesn't reflect well on them, and it's generally a bad sign when people are starting to ask or starting to speculate about, you know, the cynical political maneuverings of a new government before it's even had its first sitting in the legislature. One of the other big bits of BC news in the past couple weeks is there's been a little more action on the Kinder Morgan file. We talked a couple weeks back about how David Eby said that, oh, we're not going to block permits because that is a lawsuit waiting to happen and we will almost certainly lose it. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop trying to fight it some other way. And in this case, they've retained the former BC Supreme Court Justice Tom Berger to advise them and help them
get with their legal strategy.
Yeah, with their legal strategy. And they've applied for intervener status in some of the ongoing cases against Kinder Morgan.
These cases specifically are the Indigenous lands claims and consultations. And there was a piece in the Globe and Mail today just about how sort of unprecedented it is for a government to intervene almost against itself, against other governments, in a land claim issue, so sort of take a side at all. Usually you have the federal government saying, no, this is how we view this land claim. And then you have the Indigenous nation making their territorial claim. But the sort of thrust of this is that the minister and the government are basically trying to say, you quote, can't put shovels in the ground on public land. So they're taking this approach that, all right, there are parts, and Kinder Morgan has started construction recently on parts of it, but there are parts of this pathway that it has to go through that are crown territory. The BC government owns it. And they're going to say, well, you can't come on our land. So I guess like American Southern style out on the porches. And it creates a bit of tension, which we knew would be there. And it's not clear who has the upper hand at this point. To me, I think a lot of environmentalists are really happy to see this after the sort of hedging language of David Eby a couple of weeks ago, but it's still a very, you know, interprovincial infrastructure projects are a very strong federal jurisdiction issue, so it's hard to for a provincial government to overrule it.
But that hasn't stopped Jason Kenney from coming out swinging against the BC government and promising repercussions if the Trans Mountain pipeline's blocked.
Which is a very, like, Trumpian approach to negotiations. Kenny has no more power to get this through than Rachel Notley, and if anyone has a better chance right now, it's probably Notley, just by the fact that she seems to get along with other levels of government generally pretty well. There was a meeting between Horgan and Notley, I think, or Horgan and Trudeau, but in apparently neither of those cases did Kinder Morgan come up officially, which seems doubtful.
It just came up unofficially, yeah, probably. But, you know, Jason Kenney kind of has a somewhat valid point about, you know, provinces shouldn't try and block the exports of other provinces, but that any moral high ground's lost pretty quickly when he then threatens to do the same thing and start a trade war within the country, which is just a little bizarre.
Well, Kenny's running for the United Conservative Party leadership in Alberta, so he's got to make noise. And even if he was leader, he would be trying to take on Rachel Notley, so he's going to make noise no matter what. In other people sort of making a lot of noise and wars of words, there's been a sort of series of expected layoffs within the various levels of BC government and Crown corporations. And for the most part, they've been smooth. They weren't unexpected.
It's the usual sort of thing that happens when a new government comes in. All the political appointments get shuffled off and the new political appointments get made.
But every once in a while, a long-standing grudge sort of comes up and bites you in the ass, which is apparently what happened in the case of Gordon Wilson. Wilson has a sordid BC political career, as apparently every character in this province does. His is especially sordid, as he was formerly the leader of the BC Liberals in the late 80s, early 90s. But then he created this party called the Progressive Democratic Alliance, which he was, I guess, the sole MLA for a while, before he crossed to the NDP in 1999 and got a cabinet seat under, I think, the Glenn Clark government at the time. He then ran for leadership the next year, but pulled out, endorsing one of the other candidates, and lost his seat in the sort of BC Liberal landslide in 2001. And then that's when the BC NDP had this sort of fracturing, and they really didn't like Ujjal Dosanjh, and he got the fuck out of Dodge and went and joined the federal Liberals. I don't know exactly what tensions came up with Gordon Wilson, but he was on the outs with the party. And so by 2013, he was endorsing Christy Clark and the BC Liberals. And people who endorse you tend to do well, and so he got a job as the, like, I'm going to, you know, bring LNG to this province.
But when this new government came in, he was one of those political appointments that had to go. However, he didn't just get quietly shuffled off into the background. So when they were announcing his departure, Minister Bruce Ralston decided to, you know, take a swing at him and suggest that he'd done absolutely no work and basically just got a nice cushy government paycheck for sitting around doing nothing for a bunch of years.
And John Horgan joined in the fun and claimed that Wilson produced, quote, no briefings, no reports, and not even a memoranda during his time on the job.
You see, that's a slight problem, because it turns out he did. And only does it turn out he had done that, but the NDP's own opposition research team had gotten their hands on some of the reports he'd done during a previous Freedom for Information request. So not only did the NDP get this wrong, but like they got this badly wrong, and consequently, Gordon Wilson was a little annoyed and filed a lawsuit.
Well, he did a lot of saber-rattling at first, sort of yelling, this is unfair, they're defaming me, they've ruined my reputation. It's partisan politics, I take that as a bit rich, but the claim was made, it's obviously false. So Ralston first, and then Horgan subsequently apologized for the comments and sort of walked it all back. But I guess that wasn't enough, because just today we saw that Ralston has filed a defamation lawsuit seeking damages of $5 million, with maybe like a pinky finger to his lips as he says it. He's also, of course, looking for, I guess, another round of apologies and other things. It's not clear if he has a strong, like, it seems like he has a case, but then saying the apology and the backtracking seems to reduce the actual how much did you damage his reputation kind of thing. It'll probably end up in a settlement, and it's going to be a dumb, costly mistake for Borgen and frankly the province of BC.
Yeah, this was entirely a self-inflicted wound on the part of the NDP, and there was no need to make a big scene out of firing Gordon Wilson or lie about the job performance he'd done going into it. So it just kind of makes the new government look petty, partisan, and a little incompetent.
Well, another area where the NDP is trying to take some action but getting a little bit of criticism is they followed through on their promise to end the grizzly bear trophy hunt by announcing a new ban that's going to take place effective November 30th. The trophy hunting of grizzly bears has always been pretty controversial because it's not really a scientific cull that's necessary sometimes, arguably, for conservation efforts. And it sort of sets off that compassion of, like, why are we killing these majestic animals? So they said, all right, we're going to ban this. But there's a few exceptions. It turns out they are going to allow the hunting for meat to continue, but you won't necessarily have to use the whole bear. So it's not a sort of like indigenous exception. It's a, I want to have a grizzly bear jerky, I guess, exception. And that one's already gotten a bit of blowback, including from Green Party leader Andrew Weaver. And there's a couple other sort of little loopholes that are getting a bit of pushback from other activists who go, you know, we wanted a really good ban, but virtually no one hunts grizzlies for food. So it's still basically a trophy hunt because you're going to have someone kill this bear, say it's for food, but then just run off with the hide. And so it'll be interesting to see if they change course a little on this. Overall, in BC, we have about 250 grizzly bears who are killed annually by hunters, which the Natural Resources Minister has also called sustainable for the population of 15,000. But it's about public opinion, which is also a bit of a, you know, it's okay that this many bears are dying. Scientifically, they won't destroy the population. But people don't like it, so we're going to ban it, which is just kind of a weird, just in terms of messaging your ban. You don't need to talk about how sustainable the current status is.
Yeah, it's a little weird. But what I think is actually most interesting about this, and this ties in some of the stuff we've talked about this week and others, is it kind of shows the shape of what the Greens and NDP's relationship is going to be. And Weaver's clearly not hesitant about coming out swinging against the NDP when he feels they aren't doing what they should. So it's definitely shaping up. You know, between this, the card check for secret ballots on the union certification, the fundraising, a couple other ones we've talked about in the past, and it just, I think, is going to kind of really shape up to be a contentious legislative session when it comes back on September 8th.
Yeah, I think this is the smart play for Andrew Weaver and the Greens. If they are an opposition party, technically, they have agreed to vote yes on certain points and times, but otherwise, if they were in a more coalition, a formal situation, they'd be subsumed and forgotten about. By staying a bit separate and being vocally separate on issues that are reasonable for their base. I mean, their base is very anti-grizzly bear trophy hunting, so speaking up about loopholes is important. Their base, some of it, is more economically centrist, so taking the different stand on labor union certifications makes sense to them. It keeps his party in the news.
Yeah, and that's actually been something interesting as well, is that I've seen Andrew Weaver's name in the news much more than Rich Coleman's. So it's, we'll see what happens when the legislature actually comes back into session, but
we should also say there has been an announcement of the shadow cabinet for the BC Liberals, I think. But it so didn't register that we didn't even put it in our show notes. So it's also like, does it really matter when it's during a leadership race? But speaking of the Greens, here in the city of Vancouver, the race for the empty seat on city council has one more candidate, with Pete Fry, who's run for the Vancouver Greens before, promising to run again. We don't have much to say about Pete Fry. He's got a history of activism in local politics and has been involved in the Green Party.
Ran in 2014.
My favorite part is that apparently he was in design work, and I guess he was a very early adopter of technology, so they called him Digiboy. And the Vancouver Courier piece that I found from 2014 highlighted this, that says he keeps that moniker to this day, so we are bringing it to 2017. Pete Digiboy Fry. And it also sort of ended by talking about how he likes long walks with his dog, and you can find him in these places, and it was a little bit like a dating
profile. Was one of them OKCupid?
Yeah, maybe. If the Greens are your kind of party, Pete Fry, Pete Digiboy Fry, I guess, is your guy.
So Victoria's looking to bid on the 2022 Commonwealth Games, and the bid committees just announced their budget of $955 million for a set of games they held 30-some-odd years prior in Victoria, but they want to bring back for some reason, because I guess sports are just that great for the local economy, as they apparently are trying to spin this as.
These bids are always so mixed in general, because for the most part, they seem like economic sinkholes that just leave cities and local governments deeper in debt than they were. You sometimes get some nice infrastructure projects out of it. Vancouver definitely did. And Vancouver actually managed to make its Olympics work.
It's kind of the exception rather than the rule. And we could... The Canada Line was a great addition to the city, and that we got that out of it.
The refreshed Sea to Sky Highway.
Yeah, Olympic Village has turned into a success. So there's been a few good things that's been...
The more typical example is Montreal, where I was for a day, where right now the Olympic Stadium is being used to house Haitian refugees who are flooding the border across into Quebec, fleeing the States. So
yeah, these sort of sport events tend to just leave a lot of run-down, empty cities, and... There's been a few good photojournalism pieces in the past where they just kind of go to all of these former Olympic sites, 10, 15 years later. And a lot of them get really dilapidated. They don't use it. There isn't the money going forward 10, 20 years out for maintenance, for, big activities in there. And it just tends not to be a great long-term investment. And in Victoria's case, they're looking to have a regional stadium in the West Shore area, and which is later going to be converted into an Olympic size ice rink. And they're also looking to expand the Commonwealth pool, which was built for the last Commonwealth Games in 94 that Victoria hosted. And it's just one of those things that I'm not really sure is going to be a good long-term investment for them. And they're pitching a few things like, we'll spend some money to widen the highways as part of this. But they've even pitched as solving the Tollwood crawl, which, A, highway widening doesn't solve traffic problems. And B, having been stuck in that, I don't think anything will ever solve the Tollwood crawl.
Well, and at the same time, Vancouver is actually looking at hosting some of the 2026 FIFA World Cup matches. And while we have a good stadium to host it, BC Place, its own boondoggle from past government misadventures, could probably be just fine, maybe just like fix it up a little bit. But World Cup doesn't really have a great reputation in terms of its recent history, in terms of other governments engaged building into it.
Yeah, and Canada just seems a weird choice for it, because we're not much of a soccer country, we don't have a good team. And it's just one of those things that, if you're going to be spending a whole bunch of money, nearly $1 billion in Victoria's case and probably a bunch of money in Vancouver's as well, it's just one of those things where, is this really what these areas need? Vancouver has a bunch of wealth. If you're going to spend a bunch of money on something, make the new Broadway line go out to UBC rather than stopping at Arbutus. And Victoria's case, they still need to finish their wastewater treatment plant rather than dumping in the ocean, and fix the bridge that's been a boondoggle downtown and still half built and not much happening. There's just so many other things you could spend a billion plus dollars on in both cities that it seems a weird thing to focus on.
Yeah, I never know who the market for these bids are. It's never like a bunch of locals are like, what our city needs to do? Go massively in debt and hold a giant sports event. It seems like it's just once politicians get in, they get lobbied and are like, this would be a great idea. And it's just like a sales pitch that goes through them. It's never really a grassroots
thing. Yeah.
Communities do get engaged, and there was a community of people in Vancouver who were really excited about the Olympics once it was sort of announced, but it wasn't like 20 years earlier. They're like, what Vancouver needs? The Olympics.
Yeah, but the success of the Vancouver Olympics, I think, says spawned a bit of this too, where, you know, because the Vancouver Olympics were actually really successful as far as Olympics goes and worked out well, it's, you know, everyone else kind of lost sight of the fact that Olympics are bad investments generally. So there's, I think, a little bit of bias here towards looking at the one successful example that's close by and ignoring all of the other problems.
Well, moving out of BC, the other, I guess, big bombshell in the last couple weeks in Western Canadian politics was Brad Wall, the most popular premier in Canada, though that's not saying much anymore, announced his resignation as leader of the Saskatchewan Party and premier of Saskatchewan. Wall has sort of had a tough few months as the economy is starting to take a nosedive in the province, and he's cut everything from libraries to regional bus services to, I don't know, taking kids' candy on the street to try to pay for the deficit.
Yeah, his approach to the economic slowdown has been to try and cut rather than maintain, you know, existing service levels or even trying a little counter-cyclical spending there. But I don't think it's worked out all that well for him, and it's kind of not what you're supposed to do in these situations. You know, and he still managed to end up with the deficit regardless, so, you know, that goal hasn't even been met.
Austerity has worked so many times before. If we'll do it one more time, you know, on steroids, this time it'll be good.
But he's still pretty popular, so it's led to a little speculation on why he's quitting now. Well, he's ahead.
He's also pretty young. He's, I think, barely 50.
I believe 51.
And so there is possibilities for him to, you know, disappear from politics for a couple of years, maybe once the Conservatives flame out in 2019, make a national leadership run.
Well, his name was tossed around before this last leadership race as a possible contender for the Conservative Party.
Does he speak any French?
I don't think so, but, you know, that didn't stop 12 of the 14 candidates like that from trying their hand at it. So, you know, there's definitely a theory that he might, you know, kind of sit in this one out and wait for Andrew Scheer to quite likely lose the next election and possibly his job and try and make a play for that, but a little early to say.
Well, the one thing this does set up is leadership races in the three western provinces for the right-wing party. You have the BC Liberals, who have, I guess, the sort of right-wing all the way to the sort of more liberal side. You have the United Conservative Party in Alberta that's pretty much the right-wing guys. Derek Vildebrandt announced he's not running for that leadership, to many people's surprise. He's actually going to endorse Jason Kenney.
Well, he's also out of the UCP caucus now.
Yeah, I almost forgot. That was an amazing story because it turned out he was both renting out the apartment he was getting through his housing allowance on Airbnb, and I think also falsely claiming some meal expenses or something. So he was basically getting free housing and free food from the government, you know, like a true socialist.
And then the following day, it surfaced that there's a hit-and-run allegation that it, or potential charge, I'd have to double-check on that, that's resurfaced just now. So he's basically very scandal-prone and on his way out, and he announced his resignation from the caucus.
So yeah, he's sitting as an independent in Alberta, and meanwhile you have Jason Kenney and Brian Jean still running, and you have Doug Schweitzer, the Calgary lawyer, who also came out this past week saying the other two need to condemn the white nationalists in Alberta and rebel media, which we can get to in a bit. And I think it's been a little bit of radio silence. I haven't kept up because things are evolving quickly on Rebel. But then in Saskatchewan, I don't know anything about Saskatchewan politics besides Brad Wall right now.
So that's he has been Saskatchewan politics.
So I have no clue which way the Saskatchewan Party leadership race could go, whether it'll go more into the sort of far-right stuff that's been a bit tempting in Alberta, or if it'll be more like the BC Liberals, which I suspect will be pretty much like the last three, sort of. Are we more like the federal Liberals, or are we more like the federal Conservatives under Michael Chong, or even a
Joe Clark.
Yeah, or even a Harper without some of the religious stuff. But, you know, it's in the backbench. So we'll keep an eye on all three of those races, I guess.
And finally, for a roundup, the NAFTA talks have started this week. And Canada, just before that, released their key goals and list of demands. So there's a new chapter on labor standards that Canada wants and environmental standards. I suppose a chapter on gender rights, which we were talking about before a recording, which seems like a somewhat odd thing to put in that it doesn't seem to be an obvious bit of language in a trade deal that comes out of that.
Well, that and the chapter on Indigenous rights are approaching sort of peak Trudeau in terms of, you know, mouthing the right languages, especially when you have Donald Trump south of the border and his team who are not known for stances on gender rights or Indigenous rights. They're not even talking about First Nations in America right now. I can understand bringing gender-based analyses to trade discussions. That's been something they brought to all policies across the federal government, and I think Alberta has been doing it as well. And there's a good episode of the broadcast podcast in out of Edmonton that talked about what gender-based analysis plus is. And it's the idea of sort of for each policy you bring in, try and look at, will this have disparate effects on men versus women versus non-binary people, I guess. And so I could see a trade impact that affects an occupation that's primarily men or women and trying to look at it a bit. I don't know how it becomes a whole chapter rather than, like, we should apply this to the...
Yeah, it would make more sense not as a chapter, but as a kind of principle in which Canada's approach in the negotiations.
But we're not going to talk the US into that at this point.
Yeah, and that's kind of fed some speculation that Canada really isn't expecting anything to come out of this, so they're just, you know, signaling their own Trudeauing, you know, these are the things we really care about as a government, but, you know, maybe not the actual policy goals we're going for.
Or we even just drag our feet for long enough that Trump either gets impeached or something else happens, and, I don't know, we deal with Pence and his team?
Yeah.
Which would probably be a little bit less random on trade.
Yeah, and Canada's also been doing a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes diplomacy. McLean's actually had a good piece where they went through all the trips the various Canadian government figures have been making to the U.S., and it's quite extensive, and they're basically trying to rope every American every American politician is even a little sympathetic to the idea of free trade into the, we want to keep this thing going. But, yeah, some of the other items in the listening demands want some reforms to Chapter 11, which is the investor-state dispute mechanism. And the one that's kind of got a lot of criticism. Specifically, they want to have a very clear stipulation that, you know, still ability to regulate in the public interest. They want to expand some of the rules around procurement to make the, you know, Buy American, which has been a constant thorn in the side of Canada around U.S. government procurement. And it even led to some ridiculous stuff like a ferry terminal that's in B.C., but is operated by the Alaska State Highway System, had to use American steel and a project that was actually happening in Canada. So there's that sort of thing that's been a major annoyance, something they want to address. And, of course, you know, it wouldn't be a Canadian trade deal without trying to protect the supply management system for the dairy industry.
Gotta keep Maxime Bernier angry.
Yes, and 11,000 farmers happy because that's apparently an overriding government interest.
This past week, most North Americans, at least I hope most, were pretty horrified by the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. And here in Vancouver, there's been a lot of talk about this upcoming rally by white supremacists and related groups here in the city. And there's been a lot of interest in sort of a counter-protest that's been organized. And we're lucky to be sitting down with two of the organizers. So why don't you introduce yourselves?
So I'm Annie Lohanna. I'm a public school educator. I'm an Aboriginal teacher advocate. I'm a social justice curriculum specialist, and I'm Jewish.
And I'm Lisa DeCary. I'm a teacher as well, but I teach science and math, so most of my activism is outside of the classroom. I've been a union rep for my school for about 26 years, and I've been involved in social justice work since I was in university a long time ago.
And so maybe give us a little bit of background. What's this rally that's happening on Saturday all about? Like, where did that come from?
You're too polite, Annie. So the rally that the right wing organized, that actually was the stimulus for us to organize our counter protest, initially was organized by a group called, I believe, WCAI, Worldwide Coalition Against Islam. There are a number of these small right wing groups, and they often would have rallies in front of City Hall. I know in Toronto they were doing them every month, but the groups were super small. They might be 10 people, 20 people. And in June, I think this group or an affiliated group did a rally of about 50 people. That's the biggest we'd ever seen. And then we didn't see them again over the summer. Then we heard that they were doing this rally on August 19th. And they were inviting Soldiers of Odin, another right-wing group that we have had some dealings with, some of us. So once we heard that, then we decided to organize our counter-protest.
And to make it clear that Soldiers of Odin, we know, have been handing out pamphleture in various communities. I think they have shown up to at least one mosque, is my understanding, if not more so. So they've been pretty active, I would say, in terms of like low level community kind of engagement, which means, you know, one-on-one, families, things of that nature.
Are there any other groups involved, or is it kind of just the ones that are, or if you don't
know? I know I saw on the website this Cultural Action Party. Is that one you've come across before?
I think I've heard of them. There's so many of these tiny groups. So CAPA, I knew, stood for something like that. Yeah. To be honest with you, I haven't spent that much time recently looking at them again. We've sort of seen them pop up. There was another one. It had three C's in their name. C, 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 C. Some of them popped up around the Omar Khadr decision. Some of them around M103, because, you know, they just couldn't stand it that we said Islamophobia was wrong and hate speech was wrong. And those little groups would pop up, but then we didn't necessarily see them again for a while.
Yeah.
So what motivated you to put together a Facebook event and say, let's counter-protest?
Well, I had actually reached out to some people in June, and I can't remember, Annie, if you were one of them, but mostly people I knew from union work. Trade unionists, people interested in social justice, because we thought this might be coming, because they are attempting to organize across Canada, and, you know, they're bigger in Toronto and Montreal, and they've been smaller here. And so we knew it might be coming. So I reached out to people, and everyone kind of said, oh yeah, well, we're busy, we'll get to that later. And then we heard about the protest. I heard through the grapevine, someone in Toronto must know someone in one of these groups or whatever. The message got to us that it was actually on. And that was only about 5 days ago.
Yeah.
So we had about a week to organize a counter protest. And we just thought, we can't let this go unimposed anymore.
Mm-hmm. And certainly for myself, we kind of had the same mindset. So literally reaching out to her and going, oh, right. No, absolutely. Let's do this. But I think in a more serious fashion, that many of the people that are most alarmed, are have the most fear, you know, about these groups, you know, coming to City Hall and doing this action, they face this every day. So really, this is just an accumulation over years, decades, centuries. And it behooves us to listen to these groups, to listen to these, you know, Canadian citizens, these human beings that are really struggling under the yoke of racism across the board, not just someone with a Nazi flag screaming at them. So I know it's been festering with me. It's been something that just, as things got worse and worse and Trump and all of that, the backlash to things like Omar Khadr and like hate crime and things like that, I really couldn't stand it. And it came to a breaking point for me.
So I just want to touch on one thing you mentioned, that it's a lot more prevalent in kind of the central and eastern Canada. Do you have any idea why there's that kind of geographic breakdown?
I thought it was partly just those are bigger cities. I don't know. I think that there's this meme out there that somehow Quebec is more racist. And I don't think that's true, because Quebec is also way more left-wing and has a lot more sort of a history of a labor movement fighting for things. You know, that's why they had things like, very reduced tuition fees. And, you know, when I lived there, when I was little, things like free dental care, right? You know, a little more social democracy. So I don't know. I thought it was just, you know, the bigger cities. That's where they were able to really build. There has unfortunately been a problem with the PQ, the Parti Québécois, sort of feeding into this.
The values charter.
Values charter. So the same thing you see in France where like, oh, secularism is something so great. And then we're going to use that to attack Muslims. Secularism never seems to be. You can't wear a crucifix.
Even the Quebec Liberal Party is now expanding Bill, what is it, 62 or something? Whatever bill is the new secular charter. But And it was just to ban generally government workers from wearing overt religious symbols. But now it's like maybe even if you're like taking the bus, it might apply to you, which is pretty extreme, it seems.
Good God. Yeah, which is interesting. It reminds me of a quote by MLK Jr. about negative peace and positive peace. And it seems like there are some people that are just willing to sell themselves or sell their beliefs away to some notion of peacefulness, which we know is not true. And we see that in Europe. We see that everywhere. To get back to the point about whether it's East or West, I guess it depends on who you talk to. South Asian community, when you talk to them about what they face, the Asian community, and I know I'm speaking in general terms, but a lot of different people of color, marginalized peoples, they'll give you a lot of evidence here that you know, it's been ongoing for it's just never ending, right? And of course, same holds true for Indigenous. So I don't know. Perhaps we hear more about it because it's a larger city, TO, Montreal, something like that. Maybe it's just media attention. But I would say that, unfortunately, it's kind of widespread in pretty much every city.
I've definitely seen a lot of reports out of Alberta, where I grew up in. Mm-hmm. So rural Alberta, especially with the Notley government, seems to have triggered a lot more stuff. Mm-hmm. I was looking at one of the pages that actually posted the white supremacist rally, and they, a couple months ago, when Notley wore a headscarf to say Happy Eid Mubarak to the Muslim community, they just reposted that. It's like, well, I don't think they're supporting her in that fashion, because the first comment under there had some profanity and misogynistic comments, of course. But so it's definitely like, I think across Canada, but maybe let's bring it back to BC.
Yeah.
What kind of things in BC's history do you think, because racism isn't a new thing here, is it?
Where do you want to begin? You know,
well, let's not do the whole history.
No, but you know what? You know, I mean, we should have started with the Aboriginal recognition of territory. So you know what I mean. So in the sense of the idea of having settler colonialism coming in, having that genocide occur, I mean, that really is kind of at the foundation in terms of. And I noticed that in the media, there's nobody talking about that down south. Because I went to school in the southern United States, and in high school, I know they don't talk about it. So, and here we're just starting with a group, Indus Media, about World War I contributions by South Asians. And now over a million South Asian, mostly Punjabi individuals fought for the Commonwealth. And there's a lot, it's a very deep story, but the reality is we don't recognize those people, or we're just starting that now in terms of their contribution outside of the whole colonial kind of argument, right? The Asian riots in 1907, you know, Chinese exclusion, Japanese internment. And I would say, bottom line is, we sometimes teach the negative. Let's teach about residential schools. And we kind of stop there. I teach in Surrey, right? So, oh, you know, the problems. How often do so many communities look at media, look at their textbooks, look what's going on around them, and only see the negative taken back? When we look at quote-unquote white society or Eurocentric, there's always positives. You know, there's the statues. There's all kinds of things that promote this false positivity, really, right? But you see a lot more positivity. So it's very much, I think, ingrained in our culture. And that is something that is hard to address, because I think most of it right now is just about that scenario of, you know, cars ramming into people and screaming and all that violence. I think what most people who are really stepping forward to say we've had enough is that it's part of their fabric. It's part of their daily life, which is a much deeper kind of longer kind of conversation to have, right?
In Canada, we tend to be a bit smug when we look south of the border, especially within the past year and a half, but you know, it's been going on forever. So there's kind of a tendency to say, oh, you know, that's just the States, it's all that. But, you know, how does that compare to Canada?
That's a good question. I think that is something that we learn. I find it very hard at school to sit through the Remembrance Day ceremonies where, you know, people, well-meaning people, get up to the podium and say, well, we have a history of being peacekeepers. And actually, my husband was in the army. And, you know, we're different, right? We're not violent. Like, they don't say like the United States, but, you know, that's what we're thinking. My husband was in the army and he actually left once, you know, he did some reading and kind of looked at what were we fighting for. And he said, you know, oh my God, you know, Lisa, I found out that we were actually fighting on the wrong side. You know, he read a book by Smedley Butler called War is a Racket, and talked about how, and this is somebody who was a decorated American general, but basically talked about how when the West is going to war, it's often to ensure markets for products. It's not really, you know, for our safety. It's not really anything to do with making it better for people. You know, the whole, we had to, in order to save the village, we had to destroy it, right? You know, and if you look at our intervention, Canadian intervention and American intervention in the Middle East, and look at, well, the pictures we never see in the media of, you know, someone posted a picture the other day and said, look at this, you know, does this look like Hiroshima, right? And it was a picture from Iraq of, you know, a totally bombed out city, and we did that, right? And how does that make it better for people? So that's not a history that's really talked about, right? In Quebec, there is always more resistance to going to war, and certainly there is more of a culture of talking about that, right? But yeah, I think it's the myth, right? And then we think that we don't have racism, and I see people posting on our page for our, you know, our rally, you know, how could this happen in Canada? And as Annie said, you talk to people of color, you talk to Indigenous people. I think in anti-Indigenous racism and Islamophobia are almost the acceptable forms of racism. I was at a dinner party the other day, and I had to elbow my husband that I wanted to leave because one of these super nice people who was sitting down and having a beer with me started saying, oh, yes, well, and things I won't repeat about, well, so-and-so is, you know, Indian, and, well, you know what they're like. They're like this, they're like that. And this is not some redneck. This is just my average neighbor, super nice, friendly person, you know. It's, and she didn't even think she was saying anything racist because it's almost become acceptable. Right?
And we have this long tradition from residential schools, cultural genocide, whatever you're comfortable, what term you're using, but also think about the SS St. Louis. Right. And after what, 7 different stops, it comes to Halifax and it's sent away. And most Jews were dead. You know, as someone pointed out to me, and we had a great conversation, how many times have we gone to war really looking at the people on the ground? Not to say that it makes the war valid, but did really the West go to save the Jews from the concentration camps? We know that not to be the case, right? In terms of the Middle East, is it really to save Muslims who are being oppressed by ISIS, by Taliban, by whoever the boogeyman is of the day? Or is it for other, whether it's resources? And sometimes, quite honestly, it is this weird, this white privilege, this hero, this white hero kind of savior complex of, we need to save, you know, those of color. We need to save those of, you know, the Orient, because they don't know about themselves. They're uneducated. They're barbaric. We need to bring them to the 21st century. What we fail to acknowledge always is who put them back in what we would consider, you know, who destroyed their schools, who did all that. Sometimes you'll find that the history of like Western intervention in those areas has lasted a lot longer than just, you know, the last 20 years.
Well, that's a good point. And also too, I mean, I don't know if you followed sort of the outrage around the tanks sold to the Saudis and, oh, they're using them against civilians. Well, anybody who looked for 2 seconds at what was happening in the region knew that was going to happen, right? And, oh, well, I'm sure now that Chrystia Freeland has said, oh, don't do that, and wagged her finger, that everything will be okay, right? So I think that sort of meme of, oh, you know, we're protecting people, we're protecting, often it's about women, right? Yeah. We're protecting these poor, oppressed Muslim women. This sort of rhetoric really excuses our military intervention, and nothing good has ever come from Western intervention. Nothing.
And I would say the socioeconomic aspect, which then actually, in my opinion, breaks down the barriers between people of color and again, these general terms of white. So when people say, you know, I've lost my job or whatever, and then they pin it on another group, well, think about exactly just how many people struggle under whether you capitalist system or whatever you want to call that as well, where people are really struggling. That's across the board, right? When you have companies that are literally doing the best to keep wages down, when you have governments that refuse to raise minimum wage, of course it impacts minority groups more, but obviously it impacts everybody, obviously. So instead of being, you know, antagonistic towards each other and pinning each other for it, I mean, can you imagine if the people on Saturday went, oh my God, I'm angry about, you know, economic policy. Oh, so am I. And they actually had a conversation. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. I really do think that they would probably see there's a little bit more going on than just, you know, white versus black versus indigenous.
Yeah, I can agree more.
Well, I don't want to get you into an argument, but Scott has served in the military. Yeah. And we're not going to debate.
Yeah.
My husband's experience might be different.
Than but, yeah.
I was in the American military system in high school. So I'm not, I'm actually, it's funny. I'm probably more, not right wing, but I would say like, it's interesting that I saw people of color in Southern Florida, and including people like myself, where there was value, where they were being treated badly by the public school system, where there was outright racism, where there were teachers, and they were overwhelmed. I'm not blaming the teachers at all, but a system that said, we're done with you. We don't want you. This is your last resort, right? So they were being picked on, right? And in there's recruitment in high school level everywhere. But it was interesting to see, even in terms of Canadian history, how much more my sergeant knew about Canadian history and was willing to kind of say, wow, look at the contribution of the, I mean, it's something that I experienced. So in my experience, it wasn't entirely negative. So I have to say that, right? I think it's something that it's shades of gray, right? It's not necessarily that we're anti everything.
Well, let's bring it back to the rallies that are happening this weekend. You're going to get the other wave of people who say, well, fine, maybe this is a racist country, but you're only going to give the bigots more of a voice by being out there. Mm-hmm. Like the Facebook event shows they maybe had 30 or 40 people who were going to show up.
27, according to what they have right now.
27. And well, that was after that. Their event got deleted. So What do you say to that sort of argument about we shouldn't, you know, give them a voice?
I think that history shows that that's not true. I'm a scientist and an empiricist, and if you look back at history, and just before this, actually, I said to Annie, oh yeah, I'm going back through and I'm looking at the history of Christy Pitts in Toronto in the 1930s when the Nazis attacked the Jewish softball team. We were talking about that, right? And then in Britain, you know, where the Anti-Nazi League was fighting against the Nazis who were building. When you leave them, I think you get Charlottesville. You know, you get they feel emboldened and they grow. And people on the right have admitted they use these little rallies as a test. Let's test the waters and let's see if there's any opposition or not. And when there is no opposition, it's so much easier for them to grow. Whereas I think after Saturday, they'd be idiots to try and make, you know, Vancouver their hub. So I think that's just not true. I think that is sort of, you know, small liberal kind of thinking that sort of promotes that idea, because it seems logical in terms of just if you're talking about like your two kids in your family, you know, oh, sometimes you need to ignore a problem and then it will go away. But that's not true in society.
And as I was saying to you literally a couple minutes ago, that these marches, rallies happen all the time. They actually take pride in having yearly marches in Jewish communities and in Muslim communities. And yet, in the recent past, there haven't been too many violent flare-ups, interestingly enough. It's kind of, they know it's coming. Oh, whatever, March 3rd, blah, 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 right? And so I find it interesting that the shift in terms of the last couple, maybe a year or so, has been rather intriguing. But I said earlier as well, can you imagine MLK Jr. or anybody else, I'm just using the biggest name I can think of, telling people, oh, don't march because it might be dangerous. Oh, you know, don't do this because, oh my God. I mean, these people walked into death. They did, right? They knew what was coming. They were prepared. And they did. They sacrificed. I'm not saying this is what we have to do. But at the same time, would any progress would have been made if everybody just went, oh, no, let's just not allow anything, right? Let's just shut it all down. And again, we can't hide from the truth. This is not just about a rally. If we see ourselves as allies and advocates and we tell people, oh, you know, we're going to just shut everything down and all go home, not everybody can go home. Not everybody has a safe space. Not everybody is going to be able to not see the ugliness of the rally. The ugliness is in their lives. The ugliness is in their everyday experience. So, you know, maybe I'm privileged enough to walk away and be like, oh no, we shouldn't allow this. And I'm just going to go home and we can just forget about all of this. That I don't think that's the experience for quite a few Canadians.
Gregor Robertson's endorsed the counter-protest. Is there anything else you think the city should be doing? or other levels of government for that matter?
They've done a couple of things already. They said that they knew we were protesting in front of City Hall and we're going to have a lot of people. So they are working with us to try and, you know, use some sort of barricades and maybe block off some parts to cars so people feel safer, especially in light of what happened in Charlottesville. Some people asked, well, how do you know a car won't come into the crowd? So they're going to help us with that. So they offered that. We didn't ask, right?
Yeah, they've been supportive. Obviously, we don't really communicate with them that much in the sense of, like, this is a City of Vancouver event. It's not. But it has been nice to see. And I guess I hope that this is not the only thing they do. I hope they step up to allow these kind of conversations, in the sense of allowing people to express their concern about racism. About Islamophobia, like you said, right? You can go into anywhere and still feel moments of Islamophobia and sadly, anti-Semitism and all the rest. It's really the two sides of the same coin. So I would like to see a real dedication, even more so, because clearly everything we've done has not stopped the problem yet.
Mm-hmm. And just as far as governments go, I know someone was saying, oh, well, it's so much better now that it's not the Harper government, right? Because they were openly Islamophobic. You know, Kelly Leach wasn't, unfortunately, the only one. For instance, when Trudeau brought in refugees, there was a policy that, well, we'd focus on families and, you know, or women, which begs the question, why wouldn't you take single men? So it's the unstated assumption that single men could be terrorists. And then someone said, oh, well, what about if they're gay, a part of the queer community? Okay, now we're pinkwashing it. Because imagine you're in Syria. Are you going to put up your hand and go, hi, I'm gay. I'd like to be a refugee. And then they don't take you right away. What do you think is going to happen to you, right? You know, I think in Canada, people won't do that. I know friends and relatives who are still in the closet and weren't supposed to be a fairly progressive country. So I think that kind of more dog whistle kind of racism, or just sort of, it's sort of the unstated, right? It's still a problem, right? And certainly I was at the airport and someone in front of me was complaining about the line because security was taking so long. And just off the top of my head, I said, well, I know women who are hijabi, who wear the hijab, and they said it routinely takes them this many hours, like 3 hours to get through, whereas it might take me 1.5. And the guy in front of me, I didn't know him, we were just chatting, said, oh, well, you know, but they could be terrorists. I said, I can't believe you just said that. That's so offensive. And then he tried to pretend it was a joke, but he said it straight up the first time, right? And that's just, it's like the anti-native stuff at my dinner party. He thought I would just laugh, right? Because it's the acceptable racism. And I think that's very, very prevalent in society.
And reminding the just like ignorance that Muslim women haven't even committed any acts of terrorism that I'm aware of, but obviously
there have been some, mostly in the Middle East, not North America and or Europe as far as
Western
I know.
Countries.
Yeah, which begs the question, how does patriarchy play a role in that? And
Well, you mentioned a bit about the logistics that the city is helping. You posted on the paid or on the event a bunch of guidelines. Maybe for people who've never been to this kind of protest or event before, what are the kind of top tips or things people should need to know about, like, their personal safety? Do they need to be worried? Should they bring a friend? Those kind of things.
Do you want to take
that? Sure. Well, I can start off and then you can add. I think definitely coming in groups is a good idea, right? Coming alone is probably not best in that sense, you know, to avoid that at all costs if you can. And really just strengthen numbers, right? Also the idea of not necessarily engaging. And so, like, you need to bring your most calm self. You need to be ready to stand up for yourself. But I mean, God knows what they're going to say, right? And what kind of vitriol they might lash out with. It is not the best idea to then, you know, kind of engage physically, right? And then, you know, kind of attack back. We don't want that. I would say personally, bring a positive mind. I really hope that we can keep it positive. We can have it be a little bit, I'll be speaking, I hope to be a little, not completely celebratory, but in the sense of, you know, let's really show the beauty of what this rally could be. And hopefully that kind of keeps tensions low. Those are just kind of a couple that came out of the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. I think that those are really good tips. And I was going to mention the part about coming in groups. I think that a lot of people are worried. And I think, unfortunately, some media outlets have said, you know, oh, this is going to be like a battle between, it's almost like the way they talk about climate change, two equal groups, you know, one for, one against. No, it's more like We have about 3,000 people say they're going. And even though we can't always rely on Facebook for the far right because they have their very tight-knit network, but because they keep everything private, that means that they are small. Also, they're crazy, you know, and horrible. So it's really hard for them to attract people. So we outnumber them, and that is the biggest safety factor. But also when people are leaving, sometimes people stick around afterwards talking to one or two friends, and then they go off and walk to the subway on their own. And if you've been kind of identified as part of the protest by some right-wing nut bar, that's a time where they may follow you to the subway and the SkyTrain. Pardon me, I'm from Toronto. to the SkyTrain or to, you know, your car. And, you know, it's not likely to happen, but it did happen to a friend of mine who had engaged with them more, who had gone right up to them and started to try and debate. I don't know that that's the best idea. We don't want to judge people who want to like yell in their face or whatever, but this is a peaceful sort of non-engagement strategy rally. If they do come at us, I mean, we've been advised by sort of experts that a really great thing to do is link arms or link hands. And, you know, if you're really concerned, then be behind the line of people who are holding hands. And then we have some people who are on the lookout for that who will come and help you. It's unlikely to happen, though.
And we're seeing some beautiful things as well. I mean, I want to give credit to Black Lives Matters. I know that's one of the key sources we looked at in terms of putting together our strategy. But also that I've seen things, I don't know if they're going to happen, but like Muslim prayer groups might show up and actually have a prayer beforehand. There's some beautiful things happening around that. And I want to say that for the those who are people of color, who are marginalized, that do feel that, you know, here they are again, right? Having to face all of this. Of course, right? I mean, again, it's something they face so often that they might be uncomfortable with this reality. I would say, you know, in terms of being a group, in terms of being solidified as one, to watch out for each other, right? To take care of each other. You know, don't... try to keep the group in mind, right? So, you know, when you can help kind of be supportive of someone else, that's better than simply running away. But certainly people have to be comfortable. And we're doing everything we can to do that. It will never be perfect. It's who knows what could be. But we're doing everything we can to really understand the kind of fears people have. And I have to say, it doesn't help the current climate right now. You know, that's something that I think is just amping things up to a level that I've rarely seen before.
You mentioned Black Lives Matter. Have you reached out to other groups in Vancouver for advice on maybe bringing in different perspectives and being aware of all these kind of things?
Absolutely. Yeah, we haven't published our speakers list yet, but we have people from varying groups, from the Muslim community, from the South Asian community. We reached out to pretty much, we tried to be as intersectional as possible with this. We tried to reach out to everybody and anybody. And for myself, I've had nothing but like complete support. You know, I can't be there, but go for it, right? Or even, you know, in terms of like, you know, here are our experiences, right? And this is what we believe in, good luck. So, I mean, it's been, I don't think there's any one group that really has said, oh no, we're not into this whatsoever. One group, I mean, like one organization, but we have tried to, and especially marginalized groups, people of color, we really were very careful about reaching out and making sure they had a voice somehow in the rally.
And I think labor groups too have been really important to reach out to historically in the 1930s. I mean, obviously these are groups that are attacked as well by the Nazis. And we actually had BCGEU offered to do sort of a feeder march. They're going to meet at one of the SkyTrain stations, collect everybody who considers himself a working class person, and then they're going to march. And it started with 17 people, and that's been going up exponentially. Every time I look at it, the numbers are higher, which I think is fantastic. I think that's a history we've really lost, right? You know, as organized labor, you know, maybe as doesn't have as great a percentage of working people in unions, they don't realize the progressive role that unions can play. It's not a coincidence that Annie and I are both union activists.
Yes, right? That's right.
Where can people find out more information?
I think most of our communication has been through Facebook. I realize not everyone is on Facebook, but people probably don't realize that if you click on our Facebook link, like I shared it on Twitter under my profile, that you can still go to the page and see what's happening. And to be honest, we're getting so much media attention right now. I think, you know, the other day I went to the pub after our organizing meeting and had a hamburger and said to my server, hey, have you heard about the rally? And he's like, oh, of course, yeah. And they started talking to us about it. We didn't have to tell him. He already knew. So a lot of people already are aware. I wouldn't let people scare you off. I don't think this is going to be Charlottesville. Yeah. This is going to be thousands and thousands of people celebrating look at what Vancouver is really like. Yeah. This is really an amazing coming together of people who said no to Islamophobia. And yeah. I think it's super inspiring.
And hold yourself to the, you know, don't, you know, yes. be on your best behavior, right? And use your anger, use your sadness, the realities of the oppression that you're facing or might have faced, to move you forward towards, that celebration, that positivity, and to be quite honest, in a way, to show them that they're simply wrong, right? Because in how we're gathering, right away, it's against Islamophobia. It's against anti-Semitism. Like just straight off. There's just from the second we started this and on Saturday, we will have proven our point. So it's not shutting them down. It's showing, dare I say, I mean, in the perfect world, the Canadian way, you know, even though we just said that, you know, that's been trouble.
It's the utopia.
Yeah. But in the sense of, you know, if we truly believe in our Charter of Rights, if we truly believe in our human rights codes and all of that, I believe that I need to be on my best behavior first. And we'll take it from there. But we are hoping to have a great time and that hopefully people go back to their communities, their small neighborhoods, and maybe start to think, well, then what can I do to make sure that racism isn't prevalent, that Islamophobia is not prevalent, that anti-Semitism isn't prevalent? And, you know, one by one, right? I mean, this is literally a tiny group of people, and I can't believe in 5 days what, you know, what we've managed to build on, even if it's a small gathering at the end of it, right? The amount we've done in the past 5 days is incredible. So I want to tell people, like, come, and even if you don't come, you know, pay attention, and then, you know, start to think about what you can do so that we go down a positive, peaceful path.
Well, Lisa and Annie, thank you so much for agreeing to do this on like a couple hours notice. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. No, absolutely.
All right. Well, and finally, building off the discussion we just had with Annie and Lisa, I think it's worth talking about one other angle of white nationalist racist stuff in Canada and what seems like the final glorious implosion of rebel media. I don't know exactly what was the first trigger this week. Perhaps it was Faith Goldie appearing at the Charlottesville protest, sort of perpetuating myths and conspiracy theories there, or...
Yeah, that appears to be the kickoff to this whole thing. Was a rebel media personality, it's not a journalist, but a personality, was at the Charlottesville rally and had some way too positive things to say about the ralliers there, including their, you know, frank discussion of the JQ, short for Jewish question. And
which she didn't feel the need to actually define in the interview because...
everyone watching the Rebel knows it, or a lot of the Rebel...
the one she was speaking to at that point.
Yeah, so that's... that got the attention of a bunch of people in Canada, and that kind of started the ball rolling with people denouncing it, conservative MPs announcing they were no longer going to be appearing.
Yeah, big credit goes to pressprogress.ca, which I think is the sort of publication arm of the Broadband Institute. So not a neutral source, but they, I think, sent a survey around to every conservative MP and said, will you denounce these guys? And they showed that something like 25% of the conservative caucus had at one point or another done an interview with the rebel. And a bunch of them, I mean, 25% is almost the leadership race. And most of them did an appearance then. And initially, they only, I think, got two, no, we'd never do it again. That was Michael Chong and Michelle Rempel, who have generally been viewed as on the sort of progressive end of the former progressive conservative end of...
Well, Michelle Rempel's a Alberta MP who's, I think, has a bit more of that reform side to her, but it's definitely... when these sorts of issues arise, always comes out on the right side of it.
But then since then, we've had Andrew Scheer came out a few days after that.
Being today, which is taking longer than really should have. And I saw some reports that there was a statement actually drafted a couple of days ago, and it took a while to put that out, which isn't a reassuring sign. And there's a lot of questions on why it's taken Andrew Scheer so long, and his campaign manager during the leadership race was actually a former board member, I believe, of Rebel Media.
Somehow involved, for sure.
Yeah, and he's now working on the Brian Jean campaign, but there's, yeah, a sense of certain amount of closeness between the two groups.
And I think some of the subtext in Andrew Scheer's comments, apparently Rosemary Barton was tweeting out this morning, he would not grant interviews to Rebel Media if the editorial direction remains as it is. And given the sort of floodgates there, it's hard to say if there's any editorial direction left. So Canada Land has done a nice job as well, sort of documenting who's all left, as in not who's left, but who has either taken a walk or otherwise. And it sort of goes back to Lauren Southern and a few others who've left in the past.
Yeah.
And more recently, just this week, you had Brian Lilly, who was a co-founder, leave. Just today, Faith Goldie was fired, I guess, after she was on a Daily Stormer podcast, which is neo-Nazi stuff.
Yeah, and it's gotta wonder, you know, I've seen a few defenses of the Rebel on social media that, you know, it can't be anti-Semitic because Ezra Levant is Jewish, but you gotta kind of wonder why it takes a week to fire someone who was talking about how good it is to have a nice frank discussion of the Jewish question.
Well, speaking of, they had Gavin McInnes there, who just quit today as well. And he was the one who, when they did their big Israel trip, I think earlier this year or last, he released a video called 10 Things I Hate About the Jews. And
that was the founder of the Proud Boys, and there's a bunch of that. Yeah. And if it's gotten bad enough he's leaving, that's generally not a good sign.
And Norwegian Cruise Lines, which they'd booked out to do another sort of alt-right, but not officially alt-right, cruise, canceled their booking, and so they're not doing their cruise. One of the funniest things was, I think it was on Canada Land, they played a little bit of one of Ezra Levant's most recent videos where he went, oh, I didn't think the alt-right had anything to do with white supremacy, but now it seems like Richard Spencer's the, like, head guy of it. I'm like, he invented the term and popularized it. It's always been there. You're lying. It's like he has a reckless disregard for the truth, as one judge would say.
So yeah, between the politicians making it clear they're no longer going to be going on Rebel Media, and a bunch of the contributors, including John Robson, Barbara Kay, also announcing they're leaving, it's just
Barbara Kay announcing she's leaving, but still holds very high respect for Ezra Levant and Faith Goldie, the one who was on the Nazi podcast, let's be clear. It's all very disingenuous, and I love it, but there's a good chance there won't be a Rebel Media in 2 or 3 weeks.
I see no great loss in that.
Rebel Media, so Canada Land revealed this as well today, is the number 50 most subscribed channel on YouTube. All YouTube. Can't wait for them to be gone.
And that's been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitCoastPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.